No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBS RadioOne. Tonight we have a special guest who's going to talk to us about a very personal legal matter. Stephen Swoboda, I hope I'm not damaging your name too much, Stephen, is going to be with us tonight to talk about legal issues on a very personal level. You know, our show deals with the rights of people and freedom and access to things like healthcare. So Stephen's right up our alley, and we're going to introduce him for in a minute. But let me just first give you a rundown on what's happened lately in the District of Columbia. There was a recent court ruling 2 weeks ago that overturned an earlier court ruling that says that the people of the District of Columbia can now spend their own budget money without approval from Congress. Now, this doesn't really change anything. Congress still has control because, as you know, they, in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, gives them complete control over the District of Columbia. But it is somewhat of a moral victory for us because the court has sided with our right to spend our own budget money. So it's one step towards budget autonomy. And in that case, it is a slight advance. But anyway, that's all that's going on in the statehood movement today. Let me introduce my co-host, Maria Sanchez. Are you there, Maria?
I am, Michael. How was your Easter?
It was good. How was your Easter?
Fabulous. Thank you. And it's great to be back with you and the programs, because we took a hiatus last Sunday for Easter.
We did.
Of which Michael and I both observed, so it was a no-brainer for us. But I'm excited to hear about your news, which is always nice that you give us an update. And before we engage in our conversation with Stephen, I would like our listeners to know that Stephen and I have known each other professionally almost 20 years now, and he's been on various iterations of my programs, from commercial radio, terrestrial radio, NPR, to podcasts and blogs. But Stephen, Michael, and our listeners on this format probably need a good background of what the Attorneys for the Rights of the Child is, why you created it, and as the executive director, what you continue to do with it. So thank you for joining us, Stephen. We really appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Can you hear me fine?
Yeah,
perfectly.
Perfect.
Okay, great. Well, it's true that Maria and I have known each other for most of the time Attorneys for the Rights of the Child has existed. So our website is www.arclaw.org, arclaw.org, and Attorneys for the Rights of the Child got created in 1997, early 1997, because I got exposed to some people in San Francisco who were involved in what seemed to me like a crazy movement when I first heard about it, a movement to try to stop male circumcision. And you know, it's probably the same reaction a lot of people have when they first hear about it, that some people certainly would say it's a thing they want to preserve, but most people would probably more have the reaction of, oh, why is this something important enough to create an organization and write 35 papers as I've done over the last 20 years. But what Attorneys for the Rights of the Child is trying to do, and we don't just work on male circumcision, we work on issues relating to all forms of genital cutting, because there is, as people know, there is definitely cutting of females. It happens not very often in the U.S., but certainly in other countries, many countries around the world. And there's also cutting, of course, I shouldn't say of course, but there's also cutting that happens to intersex kids who are neither male nor female, because parents often feel and doctors often feel uncomfortable with the indeterminacy in our bimodal gender world of is it a boy, is it a girl? So they do some surgery to fix that anxiety. But anyway, male circumcision, why do we do it? It's largely through inertia that this is happening here. There's no good medical reason for it. And we can talk about that a little bit more detail later. There's been some cultural inertia. There's been some feeling of, well, gee, we've been doing this for a long time. There's got to be some good reason for it. But like many things, the way I look at these issues, and when I say these issues, I mean human rights in general and the law in general, I'm an optimist, and I do believe that the world is generally becoming a better place. But in a one step forward, in a two steps forward, one step back sort of way. And so I think that the issue that I work on is just one of many, and I look at it as important in contributing to making the world a better place. But there are many different ways to do that, and so which sort of brings me to the first thing I was thinking of mentioning, which is that there has been a landmark event that may not be as well known as it should be, and it's not specifically related to the issue that my organization works on, but there's a human rights accountability bill passed in California, AB 15, the first such bill ever to pass, which passed last year, and ARC did contribute to getting it passed. There were many other organizations that also put in efforts. But what it's done is it's brought human rights to a broader focus, and it's made human rights more enforceable and brought it down to the level where people can actually take action when there have been human rights violations. And again, this is not specifically relating to the issues that my organization works on, but the way I look at things, we're all trying to raise awareness and bring people's attention to different matters. And I understand people get tired, get compassion fatigue, and feel like, oh no, now there's another issue I have to think about. Oh no. I understand that thought. And at the same time, we are an evolving society. We now understand that, yeah, you know, examples that come to mind that gay people deserve to get married like straight people always have. And people are understanding more about various gender identities, and I think we're gradually learning. Disabled people have more rights than they used to, and so we're proud to play a very small role in that process.
Well, I got to tell you, Stephen, that the explanation you just gave explains me perfectly, because when I first heard about it, that was my feeling. I was like, well, what's the big deal? I read an article in the paper about it about 6 months ago. Well, you know, what really is the big deal here? And but then when I thought about it, when Maria suggested having you on the show and told me what a great guest you are, I thought about it and I said, yeah, this really is an issue of personal freedom at the most basic level, isn't it? You know, I had my two sons circumcised, for example, but really didn't think of, I only have one son. Oh my God, my wife's going to kill me. My son, I have two daughters. I had two daughters and neither one of them were circumcised, but my son, you know, I mean, we really didn't think about it, right? They said, well, you want them circumcised, of course, right? And we're like, yeah, I guess, you know.
Same thing, Michael, with my three sons. Yeah. There was no thought given at all whatsoever. It was just done. Their dad was circumcised. My father was circumcised. My brothers were circumcised. My sons were going to be circumcised. And Stephen, when we first met, I was against it because of the culture and the tradition. And now, through his patience and education, if I had to do it over again, I would not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, okay, go ahead, Stephen. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to say, you know, I've been a political activist for a long time. I mean, other issues before I got involved in ARC. And I know that there's a frame that commonly gets used of rights and of violations and of oppression. And it's a frame that it's a comfortable frame. It's a familiar frame. But I'm not sure it's always the best frame to use. I mean, the way I look at it more is we're all learning and evolving. And and when I say we, I mean sort of as a culture more than maybe individually. And so you know, what you're describing of not being told what this thing signified, the people who talked to you, I'm sure, weren't aware. And as I've told Maria in the past, my son was born in Guam, which is a U.S. territory, so it's heavily influenced by U.S. culture. I mean, it's part of the U.S. And I was asked about six times, well, are you going to circumcise your son? And at that time, ARC had already existed for 5 years, but I was trying to downplay it and be cool and not come in there with, you know, slogans emblazoned on my shirt, so to speak. I wanted the focus to be on the fact my son was being born. But at one point I said to the nurse, well, there's no medical reason for this. Do you realize that? And she's quite cheerily, perkily, happily said, oh, I know. And so then the next question was, well, why are you asking me? I mean, are there other medical procedures that we offer to parents that have no medical reason to be performed? I don't think so. I'm not aware of any. So I became involved in this issue not because of any personal axe to grind, not because I was circumcised, but I don't usually talk about my situation, and there's nothing really to talk about. It's not unusual in any way. I don't really feel particularly aggrieved by my own personal situation, but I got involved more because I saw the issue as an issue that's underrecognized, and it's not as underrecognized now, I'm happy to say, but at the time I got involved in it, there weren't many people writing about it, and there weren't even that many people working on it back at that time, almost 20 years ago. And I just thought it after my period of going through the same reaction that I guess both of the other people on that are talking right now have gone through of not understanding why it was an issue. After eventually getting through that, and it took me several years deciding to work on the issue, you know, I went ahead and founded the organization, and I've been to the United Nations, and I've debated this top epidemiologist in Charleston, South Carolina, and actually defeated him, not officially, but he had no response to any of our arguments. And it's been a real, I feel blessed by the whole path. It's been interesting, and it, you know, it's a very interesting issue. I mean, it's never dull, that's for sure.
Well, Stephen, there's such a prevalence of it, though, still with the Jewish families who do it for traditional religious reasons, and then for the Muslims who do it, I guess, for their reasons in that regard as well. And we're talking about 1 point something billion in that regard, Muslims that are doing circumcision. So do you ever see an eradication globally?
Well, I mean, eradication is that's not really an appropriate, I mean, that's not really a term that makes sense to be using at this point. I mean, you know, I'm not Islamic. I'm not Jewish. I mean, on the one hand, no child is born Islamic or Jewish either. I mean, there's certainly children born to Islamic or Jewish parents, but you look at the human rights protections. I mean, the child's entitled to choose their own religion. The parents aren't allowed to prescribe that to them. And there's a court in Cologne, Germany in 2012 that said basically the same thing, that you shouldn't be allowed to inscribe your choice of a child's future religion on the child's body. You can certainly give them a religious instruction, and when they get old enough, they can make the decision to follow that religion, obviously. But to make a change in that child's body, and a change that may affect their physicality in various ways, that's not something that we allow in any other sphere. And so on the one hand, I certainly believe that. On the other hand, I'm not Jewish. I'm not Islamic. I feel a certain discomfort in talking about those religions, since I'm not of those religions. And I think ultimately it's going to take folks from those religions to come in and talk about this issue. And people are doing that. There are many Jewish activists in this movement. In fact, Judaism is disproportionately represented among people who work on this issue. And there are also Islamic activists who are getting involved. So there are many complexities to this work, and among other things, since it's been more than a year and a half since I've last been on with Maria, I'm going to try to do an update on what's been going on in the last year and a half in my time. So I'm not unwilling to talk about these issues, but at the same time, since I'm not of those religions, it does end up in a certain there's a certain point at which maybe it's more appropriate for someone from those religions to actually take over. Let me say that.
That's
well, maybe
fair.
We can have somebody call in with a question or an answer from one of those religions. But let me talk about the religion that I know you do practice, and that's law. If my son decides now that he's 21 that he didn't want to be circumcised, can he sue me?
Oh, probably not. I mean, I think what we're going to see in this area is an evolution. We're not going to see courts all of a sudden abruptly ruling. I mean, you know, there might be certain people in our movement that might like to see this, but we're not probably realistically going to see a court tomorrow or next week or even in 5 years outlawing the procedure throughout the country categorically with no exceptions. I think what we're more likely to see is a growing awareness and an understanding of, you know, where this court in Cologne was coming from that made this decision that circumcision isn't lawful, and where other legal entities and other courts in Europe and elsewhere that have made similar decisions are coming from. And I think we're going to see this seeping into U.S. thought. We had a case, an early case of a child who tried to sue the parent that was dismissed for lack of standing, but that was many years ago. So, you know, I think the law does not typically lead social change. There's maybe been one or two examples where it has, but generally, law tends to follow change that happens in people's thought in other spheres, and I think that's pretty likely to be the case here as well. And so what ARC is doing is trying to educate the judiciary and lawyers and the public to make an informed decision and have as many of the facts as possible.
So, Stephen, before we go into what's been happening with the Attorneys for the Rights of the Child, most of the folks that I engage in this conversation, and I don't have all of your knowledge and your skill set, so I just try to get them to become more open-minded. And I'm speaking like, say, millennials and 30-somethings who do have choices and more access to information, but I'm still finding them being narrow based on what their family of origin experience was. So what they usually say back to me is, well, it's been proven that it's the hygiene is better with a circumcised penis and the transmission of HIV and AIDS is curtailed.
Well, there's always a certain side of this whole debate that can be, I guess, amusing if I manage and others manage to be able to look at things that way. I mean, it's just like, why are we not looking at other body parts and how hygienic it might be more hygienic if people's arms were removed so you didn't have to wash under your arms, or you know, it might be more hygienic if the female genital parts were cut too, because then they wouldn't have to wash. I mean, I'm not trying to anger anybody here, but I have a serious point. I mean, we're only talking about this one amputation. It really is an amputation if you look at what the term actually means, and trying to justify it because it's social inertia. We've been doing it. It feels comfortable. It feels comfortable to me. I mean, not comfortable, but I mean, it feels familiar to me. I've been working on this stuff for almost two decades, and I get it. You know, I get it. I'm an American. I was born in the U.S. A lot of males in the U.S. are circumcised. I get it. It feels familiar. It feels comfy and cuddly and understood, and it is not cuddly, and it is not comfortable, and it is not understood. And let me tell you, one of the reasons why this movement is happening, and it is, what I'm about to say does not describe me, but one of the reasons this movement is happening is because other males who had this done to them as children, as infants usually, feel that it was the most damaging thing that happened to them in their entire lives. They feel like their entire lives have been affected in some cases seriously, by this thing that was done to them without their consent. Some of them have botched circumcision. Some of them have difficulties with sexuality. Some of them can't be sexual. Some of them feel tremendously self-conscious. Maybe some of them were overly sensitive to begin with, or maybe not. It doesn't matter. These people faced this thing that they shouldn't have faced because there's no real reason to be doing this, and it had a serious effect on their lives. And this is not five people I'm talking about. This is not 10 people I'm talking about. There's books that have come out with hundreds of heart-wrenching stories from these folks, and there's thousands of these stories out there, and probably tens of thousands or more once we start really penetrating into it, because a lot of people still don't know this information. So I don't want to be a downer. I mean, generally, I'm an optimistic person. My life wasn't ruined by this. There's plenty of people whose lives weren't ruined by this. But it has serious effects. And so to get back to the question, when we ask this question, the question arises, why are we asking it? But okay, hygiene. Give me a break. It's 2016. We have soap. We have water. Do not talk to me about hygiene. It's insulting. It's insulting to say, and I know that Maria isn't saying it. I know that no one on this discussion right now is saying it, so I'm not saying that. But the folks who do put forward hygiene, Brian Morris in Australia and other cynical people who put forward hygiene as a serious reason, we have plenty of ways to keep that body part clean, just like we keep every other body part clean. That hygiene is not a reason to be doing this. It's not justified in the literature. And any literature that purports to justify it is deeply flawed. Now, as far as HIV goes, there have been several elaborate, detailed studies that have completely debunked the HIV theory. There was a group of about 40 physicians, mostly European, who put something out a couple years ago, a very detailed report, just debunking all these reasons, saying the only possible reason, even it doesn't justify it, but the only even arguable reason to do circumcision is urinary tract infections. But you know what? You can cure those with antibiotics. And after the first year, it's not an issue. And you treat with antibiotics and you're done. There's no cutting needed. And, you know, the UTI thing is ridiculous anyway. I mean, the percentage is very small that they're trying to ostensibly save by cutting. It's such a crude approach. It's cost inefficient, even if you don't count the lost value of the foreskin, which you certainly should count. So all these reasons just crumble into nothingness on close inspection. And no medical association outside the U.S. is even trying to maintain these anymore. And even the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is the only organization that's even arguably trying to justify circumcision, they didn't really recommend it in their last position statement. They waffled a little bit. They didn't actually even recommend it, even the AAP. I mean, because they know there's no reason for it. And there's these few fanatics out there. There's only about 10 or 12 of them, and or 15. And they're publishing article after article after article, citing each other and often concealing it, citing each other, but sort of disguising that they're citing each other because they want to make it seem there's a bigger group than they actually are. And the whole thing's a shell game. I mean, you don't need to cut off healthy functional tissue. You don't need to do it, no matter what part we're talking about. You don't need to do it.
Well, let me ask you a question, Stephen. Is there anywhere where this is mandated, or is the standard operating procedure, or is in every case a parent consulted on whether they want it done or not?
What do you mean, is there any place where it's mandated?
Well, I mean, is there any place where in the United States where maybe mandate isn't the right word, maybe it's standard operating procedure to always do it unless the parents request that it not be done?
Well,
or are the parents always consulted on whether they want it or not?
Well, I can definitely answer that question because I published two articles on consent, which comes in quotation marks because it's not actually consent, because the patient, the baby, is not consenting to the procedure.
Right.
But anyway, it's a mess. I mean, here's the answer. I mean, there's different rates around the country, and the rates are affected by culture and by all sorts of factors, as you might guess. And do the doctors theoretically ask the parents? Well, yeah. I mean, it's a procedure that's not medically required, so they'd probably lose their license if they were found to have done a procedure that they didn't get permission from the parents for. Although, as I've written, permission from the parents shouldn't be adequate since it's not medically required. But in any event, through some strange sort of bootstrapping thing that doesn't make any logical sense, we seem to have somehow decided that this is the one procedure that isn't medically required that we're going to allow anyway, based on some other person that's not the patient agreeing to it, and it's not an emergency. So we've agreed to that for some reason, which makes no sense. But in any event, even having agreed to that, the physicians are supposed to come to the parent, they're supposed to lay out the risks and downsides like they do with any other procedure. And if they did that with circumcision properly, nobody would do it, because guess what? One of the risks is death. It's a small risk, but who wants to risk death for their baby for something that's not even medically required? And guess what? Another risk is loss of the penis, and that's small, but that happens too. And guess what? A fairly common risk is sexual problems as an adult. So you lay out all these risks properly, and nobody's going to do it. But guess what? The doctors come and they say, oh, there might be bleeding, there might be infection, but don't worry, we can control those with, you know. And the parent says, oh, okay, and they feel like, I'll defer to the doctor. Even in 2016, I mean, trusting doctors is a common thing, and it's not a bad thing. Doctors generally are worth being trusting, except in the rare cases like this procedure, where unfortunately this antiquated practice is still persisting. And yeah, so the thing sustains itself. You know, the process sustains itself, and a lot of medical textbooks still don't show an intact genitalia for the male, and they don't talk about this, and the doctors don't learn about it in medical school. And they graduate, and they go off, and they in goodwill practice, and especially imagine you're a doctor in the Midwest or somewhere, and you're a new doctor, and the circumcision rates are 80%-ish, which they are in some parts of the country, at male circumcision, and you know, you're a new doctor, and you look up to the internet, and there seems to be some nut in California named J. Stevens Fabota who somehow, for some bizarre reason, is against this thing, and you go to your colleague who's been practicing for 20 years, and you say, "What's up with this?" And the colleague who didn't learn anything about the intact genitalia in his medical school or her medical school says, "Oh, I've been doing this for 20 years. Yeah, it makes the baby cleaner. It's better. It's what everybody does around here. Don't worry about it." And so the young doctor says, oh, you know, my colleague must know. And there's another doctor that's bought into this whole thing. And is there a smoke-filled room with a bunch of people plotting this? No. I mean, things happen in various ways these days. And the point is, we don't need this thing. It's 2016. We didn't need it even earlier, but we certainly don't need it now.
So you mentioned rates around the country, and then if you can put it into perspective around the world, what did it used to be and what is it today?
Well, nobody knows. I mean, people claim to know, but that's another thing that's disquieting about this whole thing is there's no statistics on it. And I, you know, to the extent I can, I'll answer the question. I mean, I consider it's a bit of a misleading question because I think there could be a tendency to feel a little bit assured or something let me answer the question first. I mean, the rates are not 10% in the U.S. I mean, the rates are 10% in Australia. In the U.S., it nobody knows exactly, but it nationwide, it's, you know, it's certainly between 40% and 60%, and it's not as high as 60%. I mean, it's between 40% and 50 or 55%. And
circumcised.
Yeah,
40 to 55%.
There was a study that came out a few years ago that put the rates that the WHO was actually involved in that put the rates at a low level down around 40%. And we're not sure if those numbers are actually correct or not, but it's pretty clear that the rates are going down. It's pretty clear that younger parents are getting information, are thinking about this, and there's also plenty of information that the practice still continues, and that plenty of males are still being circumcised needlessly. We're spending scarce healthcare dollars. We're creating problems that have to be fixed later in some cases by urologists. It makes no sense.
What are those dollars, Stephen? Do you know? Do you have any idea what this costs us in terms of medical costs?
It's millions of dollars. I mean, nobody knows that either because nobody does a proper study. And in some, it's hard to do a study because, for one thing, the circumcision gets packaged with other procedures that get done at birth, so it's not broken down separately. For another thing, how do you quantify sexual harm to an adult male, and how do you verify it 20 years later, 30 years later? For another thing, you know, how do you track that all those children so that you can go find them 5 years later, 10 years later when they're in front of the urologist getting repairs done? I mean, there are urologists that spend the majority of their time doing circumcision repairs, and I can guarantee you, if there was no circumcision getting done, those urologists would be doing other procedures. They wouldn't be repairing non-existent circumcision repairs. I mean, it's tautological, but there is a time when stepping back and trying to get the broader picture can be beneficial here, because I don't think I'm exaggerating to say what we started non-religiously based so-called medicalized circumcision in this country in the 19th century. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say for 150 years, to some extent, we've had this mass illusion that there were reasons to be doing this thing. And so much else we're pulling the veil back. We're saying, why are we doing this thing? Why are we prejudiced against this class of people? You know, is there a reason to treat these people differently? You know, is there a reason to be cutting intersex people to make parents feel comfortable about their children's gender? Is there a reason to be cutting males to make parents feel comfortable, or whatever, to make doctors feel comfortable? And in other countries, is there a reason to be cutting females for all the reasons we do that, which, by the way, are pretty much the same reasons we cut males in this country? Social comfort, so-called hygiene, trumped up medical reasons that have little or no basis in reality. It's the same story, and Honey Lightfoot Klein documented that. She looked at the reasons why male cutting happens and the reasons why female genital cutting happens. She put a chart in her book, Prisoner of Ritual, and it's basically the same reasons.
Well, go ahead, Maria.
Michael.
I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say. Okay, Maria, go.
So, Stephen, can you give us a history of the last year and a half with the Attorneys' Rights for the Child? For the Rights of the Child, please.
It's always fun for me when I look at what we've done over a certain period, because I forget, you know, but so much has been going on. Well, we released a video, a Know Your Rights video, in September 2014 that top attorney David Llewellyn, who's on our board, is the main lecturer in that. I introduce him, and that's on our website, which is www.arclaw.org. And the purpose of that video is to succinctly tell people out there who are wondering what legal rights they have. And so we were very proud of that. We were able to – we don't do a lot of grassroots activity because we're really more working on – we put out a newsletter, as you know, Maria. We just put one out in December, and we quite extensive. We talk about the entire movement, not just male circumcision, but the all aspects, which includes, of course, the intersex cutting and the female genital cutting, and do a lot of talks. But we were able to do grassroots activity in Palm Springs in November last year, which we were really happy to do. We had a table. We got a lot of interested folks talking to us, mostly receptive, not entirely, but mostly. I had a couple really exciting events that I was very happy to be part of, both in Berkeley last year. I spoke about male circumcision, and Marilyn Milos of the organization NoCirc, which has recently rebranded itself Genital Autonomy America, but it's been NoCirc for many years. She spoke about issues involving genital autonomy, which is the sort of umbrella term to protect all children from genital cutting. And Soraya Murray spoke about female genital cutting, and Hita Valoria spoke about intersex genital cutting. So the four of us addressed all aspects of the issue. That was really a satisfying event. And there's so much going on. I'm very excited to announce that this Charleston debate that I mentioned earlier, where I debated that epidemiologist and basically won the debate unofficially, which I never thought was even conceivable, The paper from that event is coming out shortly. It's been much delayed in the International Journal of Children's Rights. Peter Adler is a co-author on that, and Bob Van Hau. And that is going to be the most comprehensive survey of the issue that's ever been published, because we're getting an unusual amount of bandwidth for that. So we're very excited about that.
Now, Stephen, as I recalled, because we spoke about that time, you actually got other medical professional physicians to change their mind and their worldview about circumcision.
That was such a you got a good memory. That was such a crazy chain of events, because my epidemiologist opponent, Dr. Brady, posted his PowerPoint he was going to present at midnight, and my spouse is actually a pediatrician, and she and I stayed up from midnight to 4 a.m. going through his PowerPoint and going through mine and refining both of them. And then I had to leave for the airport. And I showed up in Charleston, a beautiful city, by the way. And we did the debate. And yeah, Maria's right. I mean, there were four debates going on there on ethics relating to medical ethics issues, the circumcision issue and three other issues. And so there were two other doctors there who were from that university, the Medical University of South Carolina, sitting on either side of me, and they both came up to me independently and said to me, you know, Stephen, I came into this talk of yours just completely convinced that circumcision was a fine thing and no problem. And one of them is even Hindu, so even comes from a circumcising culture, and you basically completely – your evidence basically completely convinced me to change sides, and I'm now going to be an opponent of circumcision. So – one thing is, it's really a testament to their open-mindedness. Mm-hmm. And another thing is, like, my physician co-author told me that we actually know the facts better than the other side did, but I didn't believe him. And it was just a big shot in the arm for the work that the whole movement's been doing, and a real testament, again, to these two physicians who and my wife said, well, if two physicians on the panel said that, probably 15 or 20 doctors in the audience had that same reaction.
Well, we have a caller, Lynn.
Yes. Lynn on line one. Okay, go ahead. Lynn, are you there?
Yes, hello. I hope this isn't too off topic, but I was just excited about the attorney's rights for children. I just think it's wonderful. And I wondered if you were also working at all with the growing mandate on the vaccinations and the labeling of the toddlers with mental disorders such as, you know, ADD and the drug use.
Well, you know, there's lots of important issues and important work that's going on, and I wholeheartedly support activists in many other areas. I mean, this area is really so specific and so unique, and there's so much resistance and lack of understanding from so many different areas that we're thankfully really transforming these days. But the unique needs of this issue have forced us to focus on this issue and not risk divisiveness in bringing in other topics. So we fully support, but we haven't actually been involved in other issues ourselves.
Okay.
And I think go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, that's a great question, Lynn. And I know that's something that we've had to deal with, my wife and I, as parents, is the whole mandatory vaccination thing. And that's been a big issue in Washington, D.C. I don't know where you are, Lynn, but here they do have mandatory vaccinations. And there were a couple of cases where we finally, I think, won the right to opt out if we wanted to. But we had to opt out, and originally we couldn't opt out. It was mandatory. Our kids couldn't come to school without certain vaccinations, and I believe that's still true. My kids are in high school now, so it's my youngest, so it's not as big an issue for us. But when my kids were in elementary school, it was a very big issue.
Well, California just signed that as legislation, mandatory, Governor Brown. It's interesting, the different coasts. Stephen and I are both in California, he in Northern California, me in Southern California. So we're balancing the United States, Michael, with you.
Wow. It's you crazy people that elected Jerry Brown again. I thought he had retired. But anyway,
by the way, Stephen,
that was a great question.
Yeah. Yes, Lynn. Stephen, should share that he was at Harvard Law School when President Obama was a student as well.
You're sharing all my secrets, Maria. Yeah, I was friends with Barack when we were in law school together. He was whatever you think of his presidency since then, and I know there's varying opinions, but I really enjoyed knowing the man. Haven't spoken to him since graduating, but heart of gold. But whatever you think of what he's been doing, I think he has good heart and good intentions, and I'm going to believe that regardless of whatever other news I have about what's been happening with his administration.
Well, you know what,
and I thought Michael would appreciate that.
Yeah, and you might hear from him soon because he's going to need a job in about 8 months. So he'll be out there looking for a job. He'll be on LinkedIn.
He will need a job. This is true, yes.
And I also should mention that Stephen is an intellectual property attorney by trade and profession, and that this Attorneys for the Rights of the Child is a passion.
Well, I started.
It's not your day job.
No, it's not my day job. I don't get paid. We don't make. It's not a popular enough issue to attract, you know, corporate funding or government funding. We have a few very dedicated, very greatly appreciated donors who enable us to cover our expenses. But yeah, it's never been more than that. And I look back on it. It's been a wild ride. I do want to mention something too that. Since the last time you and I talked, Maria, both Jonathan Friedman, our webmaster, and I have been recognized by Intact America, which is sort of the most how would I say it?
Senior?
No, we're senior to them. And Intact America has taken a different approach, and they've tried to really bring the issue to the masses with a social media focused work that we haven't really devoted ourselves to. We've had different niches that we've worked on, such as publishing papers and the newsletter, and anyway, the Intact America's done a good job, and so they recognized both Jonathan and me in different months as being the leading activist on this issue, and that was real gratifying, and in a way more so for Jonathan than for me, because Jonathan's a younger activist. At one point he was exactly half my age. He's now a little beyond that, but I really appreciate that there's a new breed of activists. There's a lot of younger folks getting involved. They're not involved because of any of this old school stuff they hear about from their parents and you know, maybe in some cases roll their eyes. They're not involved because of anything relating to gender or feminism or anything like that. They're just involved because they feel like it's sort of a duh sort of thing, like why would you do this? And there's a side of things that we're not involved in, but there's a whole side of it's more involved in demonstrations and graphically showing things. There's a thing called bloodstained men, where they wear these suits that have a stain at the place that would have happened if the procedure had happened to these people. And women sometimes wear these bloodstained suits, which at first seemed a little strange to me, but in fact can be a very powerful way of showing solidarity. And so,
visual.
And what we've seen is, you know, and in terms of the developments that have been happening, I mean, since the last time we spoke, Maria, the Centers for Disease Control issued a position statement in December 2014, which really was just shocking. They violated their own procedures. They didn't observe the waiting period, the comment period that you're supposed to allow for public comments to come in. Just completely didn't review the evidence in any sort of even passingly appropriate way. And so Intact America and ARC actually combined together to submit a comment to the CDC explaining these problems, which we publicized on our website and which was also publicized by the CDC. And then the other thing that happened is in September last year, the Canadian Pediatric Society issued a position statement, which we've been anticipating for a number of years. And They're not fans of this procedure either. They didn't come out quite as strongly against it as we were hoping they would, but no one really is trying to claim that circumcision still makes sense today, again, apart from these few isolated academics who repeatedly cite each other and really don't have a leg to stand on. And we're seeing the Europeans coming across more and more and saying, why are you doing this, Americans? Hello, were 38 of the leading European scientists, and the emperor has no clothes, and the emperor has never had any clothes. And it's really a different world than it was when ARC was founded in 1997, and a different world in a really positive way. I mean, I think people are looking at this issue not really from an area of dogma, more just from an aspect of, why are we doing this? Hello, there's no reason for this. Until you show me a reason, there's no reason. And until you show me a reason, which is something Peter Adler and I are writing about at this very moment. Peter Adler is the legal advisor to ARC. Until you show me a reason, the burden of proof is on the people proposing to cut off healthy tissue. So you don't get to cut off healthy tissue until we prove you shouldn't. You got to prove it up front, or else you shouldn't be doing it. And that's always been the law about every other procedure except for this one that we somehow decided was okay because it felt familiar. There you have it.
That's a great way to put it.
Let me ask you something, Stephen, since you bring up the law. I'm an elected official. I represent 675,000 people. If you had a meeting in my office and you wanted me to legislate something, what would that be? What would your wish list be for legislation to deal with this?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's tricky. It's tricky because, let me backtrack a little bit, because in the anti-female genital cutting work, legislation was tried and it didn't work that well. There were a few countries where British legislation was attempted, and if anything, female genital cutting increased as sort of a response and a feeling of, well, this is our culture and who are these folks to come in and tell us what to do. And now, admittedly, it's a little different in the U.S., where it's not a case of one culture telling another culture what to do, but there are factions of there are people that basically work on this issue that have introduced legislation to outlaw circumcision, and I don't know if that's the most practical approach. I would favor starting with a legislation to outlaw doing circumcision through Medicaid, because that seems like a no-brainer. I mean, Medicaid funds are scarce. There's no medical reason for it. Medicaid funds come from the government, obviously. That just seems like a no-brainer. And I would couple that with, if there were funds beyond that, I would couple that with funding an education program because nobody could really argue with this, is giving out more information, ideally having pamphlets in rooms where children are born and in waiting rooms where parents are waiting for their child to be born, and pamphlets that can be given out by the nurses and doctors to inform the parents, well, you know, here's this procedure. Yes, there's no medical reason for it. Here are the downsides. And see, and a video, here's the other thing, show a video, have a video shot or use one of the existing videos and show that to the parents. And I can tell you, not many parents are going to have it done if they see the video first. So
the procedure.
Yeah.
Procedure of actually what they're proposing to do to their child. If you're going to do it to your child, it certainly seems fair that the parent should have to at least see the procedure first. That doesn't seem unreasonable.
Well, I've actually been to a breast, and I can tell you that every man in the room winces. I mean, it's not, there's a party and the celebration, but the actual event is not something that I think any of the men in the room are particularly comfortable with. So I think that's a good idea. What do you think about doing a campaign like we do with smoking? We don't ban smoking. I mean, we do ban it in certain areas, but we haven't outlawed it. But we put a lot of money into public education and letting people know what the dangers are if they choose to do it.
Absolutely. That's pretty much where I was going with the ideas of the video and the pamphlet. And I think the other thought I have, and this is something ARC has actually done, is so it depends on whether you're talking about, there's a different approach that you can use with parents and with physicians. I think it's worth letting folks know that their worst case scenario, there are serious costs to these procedures. I mean, worst case scenario, there have been lawsuits brought, and there's a list of all these lawsuits on the ARC website. and some of them amount into the millions of dollars. And this is just a fact that men get, boys get cut, infants get cut, and the infant grows up and the lawsuit gets brought, and it ends up costing the doctor, probably not the doctor, actually probably the doctor's insurer, millions of dollars. Well, let the insurance companies know this. It's always a shame when something goes wrong with a medical procedure, obviously, but it's such a shame in this case because the procedure didn't need to happen. I mean, every procedure has potential complications and side effects, but this particular one doesn't actually have any medical basis to be performed, so that's the real pity. And so let it be known to the insurers, to the physicians, you're running a risk without necessarily a corresponding benefit. And that's another way to let the word get out, in addition to what you're saying, the smoking analogy, the educational campaign.
I'm sure people would say that it's scare tactics, but the truth is, it's the truth. So, well, you know, why stick your head in the sand? Stephen, when I had my sons circumcised at the hospital, I asked for them to be brought to me as soon as the procedure was complete so I could nurse them. They were sobbing so hard they couldn't latch on.
Yeah, of course they were. Scare tactics, I mean, you know, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, there's so many different ways to characterize things. I mean, are you skillfully interacting with someone, or are you manipulating them? Well, I guess it depends on whether you want to characterize it positively or negatively. I mean, it's a procedure that doesn't have a medical basis. It's a procedure that costs money. It's a procedure that results in some males, being very unhappy enough that they write books in some cases, unhappy enough that they write blogs, unhappy enough that they go public. Again, I'm not describing myself. That's not true of me, but it's true of many males. I have compassion for those folks, but I have more compassion for them because there was no reason to do the thing in the first place. I know I'm repeating myself, but this is such a pity. Something that didn't need to happen. We have so many problems today. We have so many things we're trying to figure out. How are we going to fix our problems with the environment? How are we going to equip ourselves to deal with all the changes that are coming up in society? How are we going to move forward constructively? How are we going to move forward in an economically sustainable way? Greater equity is happening across the globe. We can no longer sustain ourselves by having this huge differential that used to work between the haves and the have-nots. Those differentials are being minimized, whether we like it or not. And given all those realities, can we afford to do something that has no reason to be done, apart from social inertia, cultural inertia? The question answers itself. I don't have to even answer it.
Well, let me ask you, Stephen, why don't we go after the insurance companies? If it's a non-medically necessary procedures, and I bet it's covered by insurance in most cases, is it not?
Well, yeah. I mean, if the doctor does a certain – well, I mean, I guess it would depend on whether it was some rogue doctor that just went crazy or whether it was some a direct line of causation from the procedure to the damage. In most cases, it's probably just going to be a complication that's going to be – a complication that is going to be paid by the insurance companies, yeah. And
so why don't you get the insurance companies on your side? Aren't they kind of natural allies for this?
They are, and we've tried that, and we're working on that. It's not as easy to do as you might think. It's hard to get the ear of the person you need to talk to, and it's an incremental process. But we're getting to the point where such a program is actually possible to bring into reality. So you've latched on to one of the ideas that is actually feasible.
Well, good.
I'd like the way you think, Michael, though, because he's kind of drilling down into, okay, what details can we work through in our various centers of influence? And Stephen, of course, as always, you've been an informed discussion, which doesn't surprise me. Michael, what are your thoughts?
Well, I just think Stephen, you summarized so perfectly when you started the conversation. This is exactly the way I felt, like, what's the big deal here? But the more I thought about it, the more I said, yeah, this is an issue which is connected to many other issues. The issue that brought up when she called in about mandatory vaccination and other medical procedures that we face in our lives. So I think it's very relevant, and I'm glad that you came on our show to talk about it. And I hope we get a chance to talk to you again as time goes on, because I think it is something that we should start paying attention to.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk with Maria, and it's a pleasure to be on this show for the first time. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, well, Stephen, for what you do. Such an inspiration.
Yeah. Yes, and thanks. Thanks for volunteering your time for this cause that you have such passion for. We very much appreciate it. And let me tell our listening audience that next week I'm out of town, so there's a special treat. Maria's going to be on. You get a whole hour of Maria. You don't have to listen to me interrupting her and trying to talk over her. You get a whole weekend of the best that Shadow Politics has to offer. So please tune in.
Thank you. We have a very special guest. He's in an elite club of 34. He attempted to commit suicide by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, and he survived.
Oh, right.
So yes, that is our guest on Sunday.
Yeah. And so many don't survive.
Most don't.
Yeah, I understand. 100,
I forget the number, is something like 196 have died and 34 survived.
Yes, it's amazing that it'll be interesting to see what led him in his life to that particular point in time.
Mm-hmm. And what he's done since. He's an activist too.
Well, you know what? I'm sure it changes your life if you are one of the few that survived. So listen in. I may call in with a question.
you are welcome.
If I can from the road. But thanks again, America. I'll let Maria say goodbye, and we'll talk again soon.
And on behalf of Senator Michael D. Brown and Maria Sanchez, thank you so much for listening to us on BBS Radio. We appreciate your ears. We hope you have a great week coming up. Give the people their right to vote.